Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Save big money on your next project with help from Menards. Move water where you need it quickly with a Barracuda sump pump. Sump pumps keep your basement dry when big storms hit unexpectedly. Get a half horsepower cast iron Barracuda sump pump on sale now through May 5th. Hurry into Menards. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
I'm at a point where I really want us to think about a radical shift in our understanding of gender. Really, everyone is gender nonconforming in some way. And with the history that we have, particularly here in the United States, being Black is inherently gender nonconforming. So when we try to divide ourselves around trans and cis, these aren't really binary experiences. And I think within a generation's time, we will start to have a deeper understanding of that.
This is The Secret Lives of Black Women. I'm Sharla.
And I'm Lauren.
And today we're talking about LGBTQ politics.
I'm really looking forward to talking about this, and I'm excited to talk about this because I feel like as we think about the presidential election and politics, like so often when we think of Black issues, we compartmentalize and just think of like Blackness as like, oh, it's just this issue. But Black issues are LGBTQ issues. And like we have to bring those to the forefront too. And our thoughts and our minds is like, if our sisters are dying, like that should affect you.
Yeah.
And you should care and be like rallied up to be like, who's talking about this?
Yeah. And I think a lot of us are talking about it. I think like we've had such strides socially in making these issues everyone's issues and making them Black issues. At least as far as I'm concerned, you know, if everybody ain't free, ain't none of us free. So,
ain't none of us free.
Ain't none of us free. So I'm very excited. I think we have absolutely the best person to chat about these issues. We're chatting with Raquel Willis. Raquel is a writer, journalist, feminist leader, and transgender liberation activist. She founded an initiative at the Transgender Law Center called Black Trans Circles, which creates space for trans people in the South and Midwest to heal from oppressive traumas. And at the time of this interview, Raquel was the executive editor of Out Magazine.
She spoke at the inaugural Women's March back in 2017, and her writing has appeared everywhere from Essence to Vice, Bitch Magazine, BuzzFeed, and the Huffington Post.
Ooh.
I am so excited to meet Raquel and to get this conversation started. So let's just jump right in.
Let's do it.
We are here with, you know, media boss Raquel Willis, all lotioning our hands as we just discuss the fear of ash.
Yes.
No one wants to be ashy in these streets.
Literally everyone at this table right now is rubbing lotion into their hands.
I'm like, I had enough that I'm like bringing it up my forearms because I'm just, my body's parched.
This really feels like the Blackest thing we've ever done on this show.
I love
this
it.
Is a peak, this is a peak Black moment.
Peak Black moment
peak
on SLBW.
Black lady moment,
yes.
Of all of us just like going
lotion.
Deep with the lotion.
Yeah.
It's self-care.
It's self-care.
Anyway.
This episode is not about lotion. Raquel,
about,
you are so accomplished. And this episode is about you. I'm like, there's so many things that I want to talk to you about.
Yes.
I like am wondering where to begin.
I mean, I think we start at the beginning. I mean, you are a transgender rights activist. You're a writer. And I want to know, how did you get started with this work?
It actually is really weird to me to consider that my career, right? Because I think that a lot of times activism has become something that people latch on to for visibility, right? Or latch on to as a label for clout or whatever you can think of, right? And I think there's something that rubs me the wrong way about thinking of my career as activism. I think of my career as a time in nonprofits, as a time in media, as an editor now at Out Magazine, executive editor. But it's weird to think of my activism as my career. I don't know. I don't know what that like, line is.
Yeah, it's like tied to it.
Right. But because I think the activism is so expansive. Like, mm-hmm. I think we get into this idea that it is something so limited. It is just being on the streets, yelling into a bullhorn, you know, marching with your fist up. And all of that is beautiful and powerful and important. And we've seen through history how those kinds of direct actions have shifted culture, right, and shifted society. But activism is so many different things. Organizing can come in so many different forms. My thing is really, people need to find what their passion is and organize within it, right? So if you're a writer, are you writing about things that can liberate other folks? You know, if you are a teacher, are you teaching things that can liberate other folks, right? Are you infusing your curriculum with these lessons of social justice, these lessons around elevating Blackness and brownness and queerness and different types of bodies and disability, all of these different things?
So you're trans.
Yes.
And I want to know. Yes, I think. And I mean, is it okay if I ask about the beginnings of you deciding to go on this journey?
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate this question. I think that, like, your gender isn't really the choice, right? Or your identity isn't really the choice. The choice is whether you're going to live in it. And for me, I mean, I grew up in a very traditional Southern family in Augusta, Georgia.
And you went to college there.
I went to college in Georgia. I spent the first 25 years of my life in Georgia, you know, and so I really see my Southernness as a strong, important part of my identity. And I was raised Catholic, right? So there were so many layers. I mean, and then you talk about being a young Black person born to pretty traditional parents who were middle class. I mean, you know, I joke about us being, you know, the Huxtables by some standards, right? My mom was had a doctorate in education and she, you know, educated adults for 30 or so years. My dad was a professional as well and later went back to get his master's and become a professor as well. So I had that kind of background where I had privileges and I also had, you know, obviously those levels of oppression. I mean, being Black, right? Being a budding queer and trans person. So it took me a while to get to that point where I was like, oh, no, you know, there's something else going on over here. It's not just that, you know, I'm effeminate, as people would call me, or that I was gay, right, even though I knew I was attracted to men. No, there was something fundamentally different about my experience in gender. And when I got to college and found the language and found other people who had similar experiences, it was on. Like, it was time for me to, like, figure out where I fit on this gender spectrum, figure out if I could even see a future, right? Because there were a lot of decisions I had to make, you know, when I was in college and trying to come into my identity, because I also did not have visions of a trans person who had a professional life, right? Or who had a family and who was loving, right? Mm-hmm. Had a partner and had these healthy experiences. We just were not seeing that yet.
What age did you start expressing your gender identity?
So it's funny you ask that because I feel like I was unintentionally expressing my true gender throughout my entire life, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think we get so hung up on what people wear, right? Or if someone's face is beat down, which, you know, she can beat a face.
Of course.
but it's so much more than that. I feel like my gender was so tied in how I was expressing myself. And that's why people would call me effeminate or call me these slurs. And I just could never hide it, right? Like, you know, we hear about these folks who are like, yeah, I was butching it up and really deep in the closet. Like, no, people knew something was going on with me. We didn't quite know what was different about my experience. And I didn't know, but I I felt like I was always kind of living my gender, mm-hmm. even when I wasn't trying to. And I will say, you know, when I got to college, that's when I got the education around what are the options medically, right? What are things that I actually want to do for myself physically, right? Whether it be, you know, a hormonal journey or a surgical journey. Yeah, it's been beautiful to kind of witness our expansion and understanding mm-hmm. on gender and our sexual identities.
When you entered...
I have so many questions.
I know,
but Lauren hasn't asked one in a minute.
Well, I was just wondering, when you entered your career in journalism, because, you know, in reading about you, you said that your father's death really was a catalyst for your transition, but also your career. Mm-hmm. And were you thinking of... You know, you mentioned earlier, which was so powerful to me, of like how you didn't imagine a possibility of like someone like you in the world, and that impact, like, not only am I going to be a journalist as I'm dealing with this transition, but I'm going to cover issues that spread awareness about my experience so other people are informed and know.
Yeah, I mean, I was committed. You know, I came in to my college experience knowing that I wanted to deepen my understanding of storytelling and use the media as a tool to make things a little bit better for people who were like me, who grew up isolated, right? Like, I did not grow up in New York or even Atlanta, for that matter. I grew up in Augusta, Georgia. And although there are a solid amount of folks there, I mean, it has the second largest population in the state, there it still felt like a smaller Southern experience. So I didn't know other out LGBTQ folks for the most part. There were a few, obviously, like teachers that people speculated about, but they were never going to say anything because they might lose their jobs. And so when I graduated from college, I did not find any job prospects in New York. I tried. And I found myself working at a very small newspaper in an even smaller town in Georgia called Monroe, Georgia. And I was in the closet, you know. So all through that first job, I was in the closet about being queer, about being trans. And, you know, maybe people had assumptions or whatever. They never brought those assumptions to me. My understanding was like no one really knew, partly because, you know, there are so many ways in which you have to comport yourself to be at that point what we were calling being passable, right? So that people wouldn't try and clock your transness. But then also, I just felt like there was a certain level of ignorance that was blissful, right? Even for me, like, people weren't as versed in trans identity and trans folks. And so it was a little bit easier to navigate in some regards. But it was hurting me on the inside because I couldn't write as deeply as I wanted to about social justice issues. I even had an editor he was my boss, who, you know, would basically try and steer me to write less liberal, right, or mm-hmm. less progressive. And that hurt, you know. It was hard. I couldn't really be my full self, and that meant that I was only telling part of my story, but I could only tell parts of the stories that I was interested in as well.
What helped push you through that moment to live in the fullness of your truth, both journalistically and personally?
A few things. So a personal moment, I was asked to cover the first drag show that they had in that county. and I knew the whole drag community, like in that kind of, tri-county radius. And I really had to pretend like I didn't really know what was going on.
What? And
like,
a I was drag asking, show?
Right. Like, I was asking, I'm like, drag? Oh, my gosh. What's that? Don't they look fabulous? And so I had to do that. And so I'm, like, interviewing these folks that I totally know, right? But I'm interviewing them.
Were they looking at you like, girl?
Well, no, because, I mean,
yeah, I know you have to do that.
Right. Like, they didn't know that I had to do that. And anyway, I mean, I think even where I was in my career, being fresh out of journalism school, this whole, like, idea of objectivity, right, and not inserting yourself into the story, that was a mask for me to not really be my full self.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one experience, right, that kind of, you know, being all fraudulent. And then I would say the larger calling came from what was happening in the movement. You mm-hmm. know, this was a time, you know, when the murders of people like Trayvon Martin were happening, Mike Brown. People were shutting down highways, you know, in Atlanta and other places.
This is very recent, Raquel.
It's still pretty recent, right? It feels like a lifetime ago, I think, to some people, but particularly for Black folks, like that was yesterday.
It feels like just yesterday.
Yeah. And so that was, that was what I was witnessing. But again, I mean, it also wasn't just yesterday, right? Because this was, what, 2013, 2014. So even now, I mean, thinking about it, that was, what, like 6 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
6 or so years ago. So, I mean, I was seeing that and I was like, how in the world am I, you know, wasting my energy trying to fit into another script
mm-hmm.
for these people to keep my job and survive. It's bigger than that, mm-hmm. right? It's bigger than me and the semblance of survival. And so what also happened was I was a few months into a new job in Atlanta as a media publisher for a website called How Stuff Works. Again, not related mm-hmm. to any of the liberation work that I was really interested in, but it kept me afloat. And I also read about the death of Lila Alcorn, who was a young trans girl who died by suicide. And this was 2014. And so it was interesting because with her case, she had written a suicide note and she had scheduled it to be published on her Tumblr page after her death happened. And so it was so interesting because, you know, I think there were reports about it. And then the note came out, right? And so everyone could read what she had written. And she basically said how she couldn't see a future for herself as a trans person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a video on YouTube, and it was just kind of a rant. And I was just, like, ugly crying about what had happened to Lila, what was happening, period, because there was the death of Alon Nettles that had happened about a year before that. She's a Black trans woman who was murdered. And so all of that was happening, and I was like, I have to be present and fully in this moment so I don't look back years from now wondering why I wasn't using my energy for what I knew to be right.
This is so powerful. We have to take a break, but when we come back, I really want to ask you, because your transition to expressing yourself fully has been so recent, I really want to know what it's been like for you since. So we'll talk about that more when we come back.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Save big money and start your spring project with help from Menards. We offer a huge selection of Bonnie plants, veggies, and herbs to plant at home and grow yourself. Right now, all 4.5-inch Bonnie plants are on sale through May 5th. Head to the Menards Garden Center. to get your garden growing. And check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
And we're back. So, Raquel, yeah. So can you tell us more about what this the experience of expressing yourself fully, since it's so recent, what's that been like for you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it doesn't feel recent to me. It's so funny. I talk about this with my mom a lot. We're very close. And, you know, and sometimes we'll just, there have been a few moments of silence, particularly recently, where, you know, we're just like hanging out and stuff. And I'm like, you know what's weird? And then one time she finished the thought and was like, yeah, your life is, it's wild that you've done so much, right, since college, right? And since even coming out, you know, to our family and everything, like, there was never an assumption on my end that I would be able to have the career that I've had, particularly in writing and media, but also to be able to accomplish the things around organizing and building with the communities that I'm a part of. I just did not even think that far ahead, because everything was just one moment, one second at a time. But you're right. I mean, I think in some ways it is recent, right? Like, I'm not 30 yet, so I'm not rubbing that in anyone's face, right? Because I'm in my Saturn's returns, honey, and it's, woo!
I know, but you've accomplished
it's
so.
It's a moment. Right, but I'm thankful and grateful for what I've been able to accomplish and the people that I've met. You know, I met some of my best friends in movement, and our relationships have transcended the movement space. Because I didn't know any other Black trans women really before I left college.
So that scene in Georgia, that drag scene, was white?
For the most part, yeah. Or if there were Black folks, they weren't trans. They were like cis men for the most part, maybe gender fluid. You know, people weren't really using terms like non-binary. So I would imagine, you know, there are a lot more performers who maybe identify more on a gender spectrum. But yeah, I mean, I knew a lot of trans masculine folks. Many of them were white trans masculine folks, but I didn't really know any other Black trans women.
What was it like to come into community with, like, other Black trans women? Was it an automatic feeling of, like, I don't need to explain myself, I feel understood?
No. I mean, in some ways, yeah. Two Black trans women will have completely different experiences around gender. But it really was, you know, particularly when I met my friend Toni Michelle Williams in Atlanta, Georgia, who really deepened a lot of my analysis on a lot of things, particularly like sex work and incarceration. It was really being like confronted with my privileges, right? That, yeah, I'm a Black trans woman, but I was able to go to college. I have been able to, you know, have access to a job pretty consistently since college. I had a family who I was able to get to a point where, you know, they understood my identity, and we're in a, you know, we've been in a sweet spot where those questions aren't there, the weirdness isn't there anymore, you know? So to have even that support, and then to come from a middle-class background, right? And then, of course, a two-parent household. Like, all of these different things are privileges. And even as a Black trans woman, I have those, and it's on me to always hold the duality of my experience. And that's what everyone needs to be able to do.
Well, what is it that we still get wrong as a society about this movement or about this community?
A lot. Like, things have definitely gotten better in some regards, right? Yeah, it's great. People have more language than ever before to work with. But that doesn't mean that that has translated into fundamental shifts, right? And for a long time for me, and I think for a lot of people, there was this desire to kind of hold people's hands and just accept the scraps of affirmation that people would give us, you know, but I'm at a point where I really want us to think about a radical shift in our understanding of gender. So when we talk about being trans, we talk about trans people as if we are the only ones that hold gender identities. Cis people have gender identities, yeah. Right? I mean, just like white people have a race, you know, cis people have gender identities as well. And so they also fall on the spectrum. So not every cis woman is the same. Do you think about the ways that being a racialized woman impacts how your gender is seen and respected and validated or not validated? We have to talk about that. And particularly for Black folks, it is important for us to understand that in this context and with the history that we have, particularly here in the United States, being Black is inherently gender nonconforming.
Interesting.
So being a Black woman is a very different experience than being a white woman.
Yeah.
And there is a layer of gender and access that we will never be able to live in because we aren't white women. And so when we try to divide ourselves around trans and cis, these aren't really binary experiences. And I think within a generation's time, we will start to have a deeper understanding of that, that it's really not just are you trans or are you cis. And I think that that's where we kind of get this conversation wrong. I think also I want us to talk about masculinity. They need to figure out what healthy masculinity looks like. Because as much as we get dogged as Black women or I get dogged as a Black trans woman, these men and masculine folks are dogging themselves and they don't even know it.
Whew.
They don't even know that they have put themselves in these boxes where they can't even have a full range of human emotion,
yeah,
and empathy.
Yeah.
So that's what I also want to see. I want to see men and masculine folks coming into a healthier version of themselves. And we don't have to demonize masculinity writ large for that to happen.
Oof. Oof.
Okay, and then the last thing I'll say.
Keep talking.
Please.
I'm like, just listening.
When going back to this idea of a radical shift around how we think about gender, it goes beyond, you know, this pronouns conversation. You know, I think everyone is like, okay, well, what we can do is we can respect pronouns. And mm-hmm. if you can get that down, then you're radical and you've got it. No. Like, that's
the floor.
Not really it. Mm-hmm. It's really the floor. It's basement. No, I mean, I think if we think about radically shifting our thoughts on gender, what does it mean to bring children into a world and not put our expectations on them around gender from conception to them, you know, becoming their own adult, right? What does that look like? You know, it looks like us having more flexibility in our households, you know, where children can play and experience things that interest them rather than us throwing, you know, our masculine standards at kids we want to call boys or our feminine standards at kids we want to call girls, right? Everyone is gender nonconforming in some way. And so if we can expand that, we can stop putting these restrictions on folks, save your money with these gender reveals, then we will really shift these things.
Yeah. I think we'll see more people, because you just saying that about kids was sort of like a light going off in my head of, I feel like so much of my work as an adult is like undoing all the things people told me about myself and the negative attributes. And it's like the first box people put you in is gendered. And it's just like, well, that's not, little girls don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like little girls don't play outside. And then you're, one of the first things you're told about yourself or how you want to live is wrong, even if it's something as simple as, like, I want to play in the dirt.
Mm-hmm.
Like, your natural instincts are being told that you're wrong. And I think once we get to the place where we just allow kids and people to be will raise much healthier people because they'll love themselves and won't be told that everything about their natural instincts are wrong. Like, we've been talking a lot personally recently about, like, learning to trust our own intuition and how you have to, like, hone that skill when all of your natural instincts for so long we've been trying to fit in these boxes and these modes to be in society and be perfect Black women or whatever ideas are planted in your head as a kid, and how that's the shit that fucks you up.
Yeah.
And then you're like, I need to figure out in my 30s who the fuck I am outside of all this baggage, and how powerful it would be if you would just let people be.
But the other thing about just letting people be is, like, look at how dangerous it is when you don't. You know, like, when people feel like they have to hide, when people feel like they can't be themselves, like they won't be accepted. Like, it's such a tragedy every time I hear about something like this. But I feel like a lot of that comes from the fear that families have when they see their little girl playing in the dirt. Will she, like, they immediately start to project what this might mean for their kid in that kid's life. And I feel like we should all remember that those fears lead to either violence or tragedy. You know, it makes an unsafe world, and it makes me, like, very sad.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. I think the fear aspect is, it is. It's a huge part of it. And a lot of the ways that we are policed or we police others, because we all do it.
We do.
In some way. A lot of it has to deal with our own trauma and our own need for self-preservation, right? And so when I think about, you know, parents, I think about, like, my dad. You know, when I thought I was, you know, my identity was gay, you know, there were times when I would be able to break the veneer of, like, what was really his issue with my identity, right? What was he really so worried about? And I think at the end of the day, it was less about me, right? I think they can get past this idea of a reductive idea around, oh, you can't have kids. Well, we know folks can adopt, you know, oh, you're going to hell. Well, you know, if I am, that's my choice. Like, those things are fine, whatever. But it was about him being fearful in a lot of ways for my life.
Yeah.
You know what? I mean, you are already Black, right? And at that point, you know, he thought I was a boy, right? And so what does it mean to even be a Black masculine presence in the context of the United States and in the South, right? In a medium-sized town. And so then you're also queer. What path do you have? Who isn't going to want to target you? And so, you know, as I've gotten older and I can understand that nuance, I get it, right? Like, that's fear. But then what it also means is that there was also a fear, I think, for him around what it meant for him to then have a queer child. What does that mean about his manhood and his capability or culpability in producing this queerness?
I want to talk a little bit about your work as executive editor at Out Magazine, because Out Magazine is just a legendary literary institution. In your work, do you feel like a pressure and an urgency, especially now in this moment, to, like, just get as many things out as possible to, like, make people aware of the real issues that people are facing? Like, I think I'm, like, thinking about the election coming up and how the murder of Black trans women is a national issue and no one's talking about it. Is there pressure in your function as an editor in chief of being like, how do we put, like, fire under these candidates and get people this national conversation?
You know, I don't know if it feels particularly urgent now. You know, when I think about it, the deaths that have been happening in our community, there's been a sense of urgency for me and all of the people that I know for a long time. I think about when I wrote a cover story on Sylvia Rivera for our Pride issue back last June. It was the 50th anniversary since the Stonewall riots. And I did a lot of research for that cover story and learned so much more about Sylvia than I actually knew, right? I think in some ways, people like Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, you know, trans folks of color from yesteryear who have been lionized in their deaths, right, and in recent years, a lot of times we don't even actually know what they stand for. It's almost like MLK, right? Martin Luther King Jr., like... And I mean, Sylvia was organizing around the death of a Black trans woman named Amanda Milan in 2000. And she was calling out large LGBTQ nonprofits like the Human Rights Campaign for not rallying behind, you know, justice for her death. She was calling out the LGBTQ center here in New York for not prioritizing the lives of trans women of color and trans folks. So it's been urgent for a long time. And when I think specifically about my work, I'm one of those people that, you know, I deal with some intense imposter syndrome like pretty much everyone else I know, particularly the Black women I know. And for me, I'm like, girl, I need to do what I need to do before the door gets locked. Before I get pushed out and the door's locked, you know? We don't often have the grace of just waiting and sitting and waiting for someone to, you know, do their duck, duck, goose and give us our chance, you know, to go. Mm-hmm. No, like when I get into a place, I'll, you know, assess the landscape, but at a certain point, you just have to go, right? And the most that a person can say is no. The most that an institution can say is no. And then you at least know where you stand there. And you can assess whether you can get what you need to get done there or not. Even when I worked at my second job at How Stuff Works, I pitched the idea of a podcast on social justice, on, you know, what was happening in the movement for Black lives, LGBTQ issues. They wouldn't give me a podcast because they said that, well, we already have a feminism podcast. It was, you know, two white women who were, you know, very sweet and gracious to me, very knowledgeable.
But very different.
But very different. They couldn't even see me outside of that space, right? And they couldn't see me as a host of my own show and respect me and what I actually wanted to do. So I realized I wasn't going to be able to do what I needed to do to elevate the stories I wanted to. And then I went to Transgender Law Center. And I had a great experience, you know, made amazing relationships and connections there. And it got to a point where I had to have a conversation about how our programming wasn't really touching Black trans women directly, right? After I had that conversation, luckily it was received well, and I presented a whole proposal and designed a program on my own for the first time in my life. They received it well, and then so I built out a program called Black Trans Circles, which focuses on the survival of Black trans women in the South and Midwest from a healing justice lens. And that program lives on, even though I'm not, you know, at the organization anymore. And so that was there. And when I came to out, it was the same thing. And so luckily when I got to out, you know, there was already space to push for a deeper, I think, version of queerness and transness.
You're under 30 and you've accomplished so much, yet you still mention you have imposter syndrome. And I'm wondering how you combat that to keep accomplishing all the things that you've done.
A lot of it is reminding myself that I'm under 30. But I think that even that, right? Like, I think we need to shift the conversation on that because there will be a point where I can't use that as, like, my calming mechanism. And it's not fair to the brilliant Black women and other folks I know who, you know, didn't really get to do the things that they wanted to do until after. You know, it happens at so many different points in our lives. And so we've got to get out of that ageist kind of calming discussion for folks. But it's talking to my mom, you know, talking to my sister and my good Judy's, my best friends, you know, most of whom are other Black trans women and Black trans folks about what I'm going through. And I'm gotten to a point where I'm a little less guarded about the hard things that I go through, because for a long time, I just would not speak to those things. I thought I had to be the least messy version of myself. But honestly, the best things come out of, you know, my messiness.
I love that.
We like to end every episode by asking our guest, what is your secret?
My secret is that, you know, my self-care is love. Hmm. My self-care isn't tangible things. It's not, you know, well, I love my plants too. So, I mean, the love fits in there too. But it's the people that I surround myself with. My inner circle is my self-care, right? And they're okay with that. And so when I talk about my sisters being my self-care, my best friends and us chatting, that revitalizes me to go out and fight another fight. And, you know, letting the people that I love put me in check, right? And me putting them in check and us kind of holding each other together. And so if you don't have those circles, I think, you know, it's about acknowledging that, yes, love is labor. It's not easy. We like to think that it's just gushy and warm. But it's the hard moments, too. It's the cold moments. It's the awkward silences. It's the, you piss me off, we not gonna talk for a week because I need to calm down. If you can really see that as your revitalizing source, I think you've got it made.
So gorgeous. So
my
beautiful.
God, yes.
Oh, my goodness. Raquel, love is labor.
Love is labor. Thank you so much for joining us. This has just been, wow, love is labor.
Yeah.
I'm going to put that on a post-it on my fridge. Mm-hmm. I need to remember that every day. Thank you so much for being here, y'all, for lifting up,
you know, Black women and our secrets, honey.
We have to, girl.
If we don't do it, who will?
Right?
Okay. All right. We just finished our interview with Raquel Willis. And, I mean, I have so many notes, so many just words.
Yeah.
Feeling so informed and inspired. And just, this is another instance of wishing that you guys could see the interviews. Because, like, Raquel glows. Like,
I know.
There's like, an aura.
I feel like we're doing a disservice by being like, oh, my God, you guys can't see how awesome these people look. And it's like, we'll post a pic. But this should be a visual podcast. This should be a TV show.
You know, just a true aura. And one of the things that she said, I'm just going to go dive right into the word of the week, is she said love is labor.
That's what I have circled, Lauren. I circled that.
Like,
look at that.
When she said that, my mind just was like, ashe and exploding.
Yeah.
Love is labor. And I think that it applies to so much, not just like our interpersonal relationships, but also like what we want. Like, to me, one of the most inspiring things about Raquel is just like how she's just super living her dreams and her truth to the fullest extent and capacity. And it's just like also recognizing that that is a journey that has not been easy. And that's like labor too.
I'm in one of those moments right now where I'm just kind of like letting everything wash over me. You know, when you have to sit with something for a second, because love is labor, absolutely have it circled. But then she also said something that hit me hard. She said, being Black is inherently gender nonconforming.
Yep.
And I was like, okay, all right. You want to say a word, Raquel? Okay. It's one of those moments where I was just like, man, she's really laying on a lot of revelations that I'm just like, wow, okay.
That you're okay. Like, I never looked at this in that framework, but it's so true.
It's so true. Like, literally when she said that, I thought of Michelle Obama being compared to a horse. Was she compared to? No, that was Serena Williams. And then
We're always compared to animals, but it's just like a gorilla or whatever.
And I was just like, yeah, there is this inherent aspect to Blackness that makes it, I guess, that makes you, I guess, abnormal or something in the eyes of whiteness. I mean, yeah, a lot of things to sit with, but you know, love is labor is like one of the things that I think I'll carry with me for a very long time.
Also, she, I mean, This is another episode where we're just like, there's so many things. Love is labor is definitely my word of the week, but she also said my self-care is love.
Yes.
And it's like not face mask. It's not this. It's love.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm truly just so full from this episode. And yeah. I can't wait to get home. And I always I write stuff on Post-its and I will either put it on my mirror or on my fridge so that if it's a message, it's something that I'm looking at as a mantra or just something to remind me through the day. Yeah. And love is labor is going on the bathroom mirror.
Absolutely. I definitely feel like this episode it's been a meditation on love. And
love of self.
Love of self.
Love of community.
Love of community. Absolutely. In all of its forms. Love in all of its forms. Because, I really feel like this interview with Raquel really embodies that. The becoming yourself and people accepting you and loving you and the relationship she has with her mother and the relationship with her community and the place that she's from. All of those things are a part of her narrative and a part of her love story. You know, so I'm just I really feel like this is one of those episodes that's going to make me meditate on my love story with myself, with my life.
Same.
You know, and I'm just ugh.
We hope that you guys listen. Just sit back, too. Just go home and meditate on what did you? You said it so
your
well.
Your love story.
Your love
what
story.
What is your love story? You know, because I really feel like Raquel's a lucky one, right? Not all of us get that acceptance and that love of self, of community. But
from family.
From family. But I do feel like it's worth it to seek it at least in ourselves because that is what we have control over. You know, how we see ourselves, how we speak to ourselves, how we consider ourselves. You know, that self-care as love is a really important one. And we talk about it on this show a lot because as Black women, I feel like we're always number one. You know, we internalize the hatred of the outside and we turn it against ourselves. And it's like, I feel like, especially me in my life, I don't have room for that anymore. Truly, I don't have the mental energy to hate myself anymore. I just don't have the energy. So this is it. So let's do a meditation on our love story, on loving ourselves, on loving the people in our lives, on seeing them fully as themselves so that they can be themselves. Because what's the point if you can't be yourself, you know? Yeah.
I have nothing else to say. That was a word. Let's do that.
And I didn't even give a word of the week. I just got away with it.
You just got away. But you gave several words.
I gave several words.
Thank you guys for listening.
As usual. Always
a pleasure. As always.
Oh my goodness.
Meditate on your love story and we will see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. The Secret Lives of Black Women is a production of Stitcher. We're your hosts, Charlotte Lyerston and Lauren Domino. Our producer is Taylor Hosking. Our senior producer is Stephanie Karayuki. Our editor is Gianna Palmer. Special thanks to our chief content officer, Chris Bannon, and our recording and mixing engineer, Andy Kirstens. Make sure to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at the SLBW. See you later.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.